Well, thank you for that wonderful welcome. I always love coming here, and I'm very excited about the things I hear that are going on. I do remember, I don't know how many years, 4 or 5 years ago, when King's Cross KXC had just come into being, and there was a great big notice on the billboard, wasn't there, saying King's Cross is being delivered. And that was, of course, the whole reconstruction of it. But I really believe that King's Cross is being delivered through you, and people are going to come into the kingdom of light through all that you're doing in so many practical and powerful ways. Well, as Peter said, we're going to look at emotional maturity, emotional health. I grew up in a Christian home, and so from a young age I went to Sunday school and youth activities and so on. But one of the fears I had growing up as a young Christian was that I was doomed to a life that would be rather dull and bland. Couldn't be further from the truth. And I think the reason I thought that was that I assumed to be a good Christian was to be somebody who was very measured, balanced, didn't rock the boat. In my family, there wasn't too much emotion allowed. We certainly weren't allowed to get angry. There weren't great exuberant outlets of joy. And so that was my fear. And of course, I couldn't be further from the truth, as I said, because Jesus said, I have come to bring life, life in all its fullness, life that's full of colour, full of vitality. There was a 4th century theologian called Irenaeus, and he said, the glory of God is man and woman fully alive. I love that. Fully alive. What does that look like? Well, Galatians, Paul writes this, and I'm reading it from the Message version. He says, what happens when we live God's way? He brings gifts into our lives, much the same way that fruit appears in an orchard. Things like love for others, exuberance about life, serenity, a willingness to stick with things, compassion, conviction. We find ourselves involved in loyal commitments, not needing to force our way in life, able to marshal and direct our energies wisely. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? And so we see that emotional maturity is not about being dispassionate, but rather living in all the fullness of my God-given humanity. What then robs us of emotional health? Well, all of us have been hurt. We know that at different degrees. And the three main areas in which we're hurt in life are firstly the hurtful experiences that happen to us. This can be different forms of abuse, it might be loss, it might be illness, failure, all those things that leave us wounded. And then secondly, there are the wrong and irrational beliefs that we take on board. Many, many lies we begin to believe as normal over time. Things like my value lies in my image or my success, and many, many more. And then thirdly, the wrong choices, the sin that all of us have done. And all these different ways leave us with hurts, with injustices. We carry shame. And in order to cope with this pain, we develop defense mechanisms. We have a survival kit. And this is necessary for our survival, to help us cope with the pain, but only in the short term. And emotional maturity is learning to discard those defense mechanisms in order that we can grow up. You will be familiar with many of these defense mechanisms. There is where we swallow the pain, but of course we swallow it live, and so it comes out in our behavior or in our bodies. Another way is that we develop a victim mentality. Poor me, I can't cope. Instead of taking responsibility for ourselves, we blame other people. Another one is that we become performance orientated and driven. And I know something about that. I went to boarding school when I was 5, and I think the way that I coped with that was by becoming a people pleaser. That has its good side. I worked hard to please my parents and my teachers, But if we go on trying to please people, something inside us dies, as it did in me. And I had to learn to discard that and become the person God intended me to be. We also anaesthetize our pain, and there's many ways of doing that. We all know drugs, drink, all kinds of things work, and so on. The trouble is, we pass our deadness on. So in order to be fully alive, we need to learn to let go of these defense mechanisms in order to become the person God intended us to be. Not the person that the culture asks us to be, or our parents, or our friends, but the person who God made us to be. And I want to say that that person is far more wonderful, far more able, far more glorious than you have any idea at this moment. A nun centuries ago wrote this: be who you were created to be, and you will set the world on fire. I like that. In coming, becoming the person God made us to be, we're going to set the world on fire. We're going to leave that trace of beauty that Peter mentioned. And so I want to look at three keys that help us grow into emotional maturity. They are three keys that psychologists would teach us, but they're also keys that the Bible teaches us on, which is more important. And the first of these is a willingness to face ourselves. Socrates said that the unreflected life is not worth living. If we're just going to bury our heads in the sand and hope it all goes away, we're not going to grow. And I want to look just at the story of Elijah, who has something to teach us about facing ourselves. Elijah, you remember, was a fearless prophet who courageously went around confronting evil, speaking out truth. It was a time when there were many, many false prophets and idols in the country. Many people were worshipping the idols. And Elijah was always keen to stand up for the truth. There was also a drought in the land. 3 years it hadn't rained. And in somewhere like Israel, it's dependent on agriculture. This was a near disaster. And so a competition was set up. Which of the gods was the most powerful? And I'm giving you the abridged version. But on Mount Carmel, there was this competition. And the prophets of Baal, those who worshipped the false idols, they called out to God. They called out to their gods to send rain. We told they cut themselves, they pleaded. Nothing. And then Elijah got down on his knee, and he called out to God, the God of Israel. And it was a landslide victory for God. The heavens opened and poured with rain. 850 idols were massacred. It was more than Elijah could have dreamt of. But there was a problem, because Queen Jezebel was furious. And she said, I'm going to get hold of that man and I'm going to kill him. It has been said that nothing terrifies a man more than an angry woman. And Elijah went on the run. He was suicidal. He wanted to die. He felt let down, betrayed, and he hid in a cave. And God told him to wait there until the presence of God came to him. And we're told that as Elijah waited there, there was a mighty wind, a powerful wind. But we're told God was not in the wind. It's as though God was saying, I haven't come to blow it all away and you'll feel fine. God was not in the wind. And then there was an earthquake, and we're told again, God was not in the earthquake. There wasn't going to be some major distraction that would take Elijah's mind off his problems and he'd be fine in the morning. And we're told there was a fire, but God was not in the fire. There wasn't going to be a dynamic encounter in which Elijah was suddenly going to be sorted and he could return well. We are told that there was the sheer sound of silence. That's the literal translation. And in that silence, three things happened to Elijah as he stood quiet in the presence of God. The first thing was that Elijah was able to own and articulate what he was feeling, and he felt pretty fed up. He said, I've been zealous for God all this time. I've been doing all these things. Nobody's been there with me. I'm all alone, and I'm frightened, etc., etc. Out it poured, better out than in. And the second thing is that in that silence, Elijah gained a sense of perspective. Several times when we read that passage, Elijah is saying to God, I'm the only one left. I'm all alone. Several times he says that. And God listens with infinite patience, great kindness, huge understanding. But he does just add at the end, Elijah, there are actually 7,000 other people who've not bowed the knee to Baal. You know, Elijah had got things somewhat out of perspective. And that's what happens to us all when we're stressed. I know I do it. Nobody cares. Everybody's criticizing. We get things wildly out of perspective. And in that stillness and quiet, Elijah was able to gain a fresh perspective. He wasn't alone. And then thirdly, he was given help. God understood. God's heart, as we've been singing, is full of compassion. He understood how Elijah was feeling. And he said, I'll tell you what, I'll send you a friend who can work with you. And Elisha, his friend, appeared on the scene. So firstly, it's a willingness to face ourselves, which means sometimes a willingness to be in silence and just to recognize things are not right. There are things that are out of order and I need to face them. And then the second key is that we learn to express our emotions appropriately. And this is a lifelong journey. We don't do it overnight. And David the psalmist is a wonderful example of somebody who with refreshing honesty poured out his emotions for God. One moment he's saying, my soul rejoices in the Lord. Bless the Lord, O my soul. And the next moment he's saying, scorn has broken my heart. Free me from my anguish. It's all there. And that's the health of David, that he could pour it out. And then he would find, as he poured it out, he could be still and sense and hear God saying, but wait patiently for the Lord, because hope will return. So how do we learn to express our emotions in a God-given way? We're probably familiar with the times that we have just lost it, lost our cool, lost our temper. We know the times too when we've squashed the pain down because we don't want to feel. What ways can we learn to express our emotions in a God-given way? And the first thing is that we learn to listen to our bodies, because our bodies know our feelings before our minds do. We get that knot in our stomach, muscle tension, sometimes shaking, crying, sleeplessness. These are all ways in which our body is alerting us to the fact that something is unresolved. Something's not right. And again, the psalmist knew about that. In Psalm 38, he says, my back is filled with searing pain. There's no health in my body. I'm feeble and utterly crushed. I groan in anguish of heart. And then he says, all my longings lie open before you, O Lord. Don't you love that? All our longings, every one of them, lie open before God. And he alone is able to meet them. So listen to your bodies. Listen to your thoughts and your feelings. We often think that our negative thoughts are wrong. But thoughts and feelings in themselves are neither right or wrong. It's what we do with them. If we find that our thoughts are sometimes filled with jealousy or self-pity, it's simply telling us we have an unmet need. You know, if we find our thoughts are angry, full of resentment, it's simply telling us that there's an unresolved issue in our lives. You know, treat our bodies and our thoughts and feelings as friends. They're telling us something very important. I remember a lady came to see me. she asked if I would be her mentor, and we met up. She was a very, very competent person in a high-powered job, often flying across the world. She also had a very comfortable, glamorous lifestyle, and I thought when I met her, I have got nothing to give to you. You sound to me as though you've got it all together, and I'm sure I could learn a lot from you. But she did say to me, which indeed I did, but she did say to me that she had ongoing stomach problems, digestive problems, which her doctor said was stress-related. And she said, I don't know, you know, I'm not aware what stress there is going on, but I do have this problem. And so I remember praying for her and just asking that God would show her, that God would show her through dreams, through revelation. And then we made an appointment to meet again. Well, the next time we met, she said to me, I've had an amazing dream. And she dreamt that she was getting off a train and she was carrying a whole load of bags and she had to run across the station to get onto the next day, a train. And as she was just approaching the next train to hop onto it, one of her bags dropped. And she didn't know, shall I get on the train and go, or shall I stop and pick up my drop bag? And at that moment, she woke up. And I asked her, do you know what the dropped bag was? And she said, indeed I do. It was my childhood. She said, as a child, she'd always had to work hard. She was quite driven by perfectionist parents. She said, I never learned to play. And because she was in a fortunate position of being self-employed and she'd got the money, I watched her open her diary and just cross days out in her diary when she would learn to relax and to play. We can't all do that. What we can all do is ask God to show us what's going on, what's my body telling me, what are my thoughts and feelings telling me? And again, the psalmist did that, didn't he? He said, search me, O God, know my heart, and just show me what are the ways that I can walk in which will be filled with healing. So that's the first way that we learn to express our emotions. And the second way is that we learn to express the emotion so that they become life-giving rather than destructive. Many of our emotions are reactive. So if I'm hurt, then I get angry, or I go into a sulk and I withdraw. If I'm put down, then I want to find ways of putting the other person down. But if we take the letters in reactive and shuffle them around a little, they also spell creative. And we can learn to be creative with our emotions rather than reactive. Let me give you an example. A friend of ours who we know well was a most delightful person, very kind, very calm. He was a clergyman, he led a church, but one of the things he simply couldn't do, he told us, he couldn't cope with conflict. It made him panicked inside. And he withdrew. And if you're the leader of any organisation, church, you have to be able to deal with conflict. And he simply couldn't do it. And he told us that he realised that as a schoolboy, he'd been bullied at school. And so one day, he took himself off for a walk with his dog, walked miles away on his own, and he shouted out, I don't want to do it here, at the top of his voice, the names of the bullies. He just let them go into the wind. And as he did it, he said, I found my voice. But it wasn't good enough just to find his voice. He had also to forgive. Because if we only find our voice, it will be filled with the anger that we want to retaliate. But in forgiving, he found a voice that could stand up for truth and justice. I think of a lady who came to see me at the surgery. She was a wonderful woman. She'd been a very successful businesswoman in Zimbabwe. But because she had spoken out against the regime, she had been very badly tortured. Her daughters had been raped. Her husband had been killed. And she fled the country. And when I met her, she had just spent 3 days on the floor at New Street Station. She'd nowhere to go. And she limped away along the streets of Birmingham until she got to our surgery. And that was where I saw her. And I remember her saying to me, I have to forgive my tormentors, because if I don't forgive, I'd lose my voice. It was a painful journey, but she did it courageously with many tears. She became a significant voice in Birmingham in a charity called, and I've just lost it, Restore, thank you, which campaigned for justice for asylum seekers and refugees. A wonderful person. And as I was preparing this talk, I just felt in my heart that there were people here who needed to find their voice. For different reasons, maybe it's been squashed, maybe voices have told you to shut up. Whatever it is, I would say, choose to forgive and find your voice. King's Cross needs you. The nation needs you. We need people who will speak out for truth and justice and righteousness. Let's be people who choose to be creative with our emotions and find life-giving things are being released. I think also that there are some people who feel that their emotions seem to control them, that they're aware of outbursts that they can hardly control. Sometimes they excessive crying, sometimes just wanting to flee and run away. All these things are simply saying there is something unresolved. And God takes mercy on that. God does not condemn that. He says, beloved, let me help you with this. And one of the ways you can do this is write a letter. Maybe write a letter to God. I've done that. Pour out your angst, your fears, your disappointment. Wait a day or two, and then let God write a letter back to you. He won't do it physically. But as you write and begin to imagine what God would say to you, you know that God is kind. You know that God is loving. You know that God is for you. Anything comes from God is life-giving. And as you begin to sense what God would say to you, you will find something being unlocked within you. You might like to write a psalm, but anything that writes things down, journaling, gets it out, and you can see it, and you can bring it to God. And it's also true that it's important to remember to express the very positive emotions. I've loved having three sons. It's a very male household. Even our dog was a male. And so you can imagine when there was football or sport at any times, so you can imagine the ecstasy when anybody on the right side got a goal. It would ring around the house, especially if all their friends were in the house as well. I love it too when I come here and I hear your worship and you're releasing your worship to God. But it's really important that we learn to express our positive emotions. You know, I think one of the signs of emotional health is an outpouring of gratitude, of encouragement. I remember a man who came to see me at the surgery again. He'd been an alcoholic for 40 years. And in that time, his marriage had been broken. He was his relationship with his sons was impaired. His partner of 18 years was on the point of leaving. And he was desperate to find help. And as we talked and he chose to forgive, he really came into a wonderful faith. But off his own bat, he began to write letters to everyone. He took letters sometimes and put them on the graves of people he'd hurt. He asked forgiveness, and then he thanked them for all the things that he could think of to thank them for. He wrote to his sons to say thank you. He wrote to his ex-wife to say thank you. And he said to me that his heart, that had felt so shriveled up inside, he was often at one stage in his life to be found in the gutters of Birmingham. He said his heart that had been so shriveled was growing almost by the day. If you met him now, he's one of the most thankful, grateful people you could meet. Let's be a people quick to express our gratitude, our joy, our encouragement. It is a sign of health. And then I want to look at the third point. And in many ways, this, I think, is the most important key of all. And it's the key of right thinking, living in the truth. There is a verse that I would suggest is probably one of the most important verses in the Bible. It's Proverbs 4:23, and it says this: guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. Another version puts it like this: put everything you have into the care of your heart, because it determines what your life will look like. It's as important as that. Another proverb says, as a man thinks, so he is. As a woman thinks, so she is. This is where it starts. And you don't need me to tell you that we live in a very negative, competitive culture. There are lies everywhere, and they're endless. They tell us that our worth lies in, you know, whatever it can. The billboard will tell us that if we haven't got a figure like this or a car like that, or the lies are everywhere. And I can tell you that when I come to London from sunny Oxford, I immediately feel this sense of, gosh, I don't look right, I haven't got the right things. It's everywhere, it hits us in the face. And I want to say that it's time we waged war on these lies. They shape our thinking and they diminish our lives. And it's time to say that I'm not going to be controlled by these lies. I'm going to live under the truth of God, who says I'm his beloved son or daughter, with whom he's so pleased, who says he's got purposes for my life way beyond anything I could think, who says he'll care for me, protect me. These are the truths we need to be living under. And Jesus is a wonderful example of this. He was a man who lived in the security and confidence of his Father's love. We sometimes, I think, forget that Jesus, although he was divine, he was fully human. He was just like us. He didn't sin, but he experienced every emotion that we do. That's the wonderful thing about Jesus becoming man. We know he was a party lover. You know, anybody who goes to a wedding and turns a whole lot of water into wine has to love life and love fun. He was a fabulous storyteller. People always wanted to be around him because he made things happen. The light came on when he walked into a room. But it's also true that he got very tired at times. He was lonely. He was misunderstood. He was betrayed by his dearest friends. People plotted to kill him. How on earth did he survive with those pressures? And the secret was he constantly withdrew to spend time with his Father. We know he was constantly in demand. People followed him everywhere. They followed him across a desert, up a mountain, across a lake. They even came down a roof. Do you remember? They lowered a man down the roof. Such was his demand. And yet we know that Jesus deliberately at times turned away from the crowd and went to spend time with his Father alone. And he did this because this is where he gained security and confidence. This is where he gained truth. And it was out of that that he brought life, miracles, restoration to people's lives. And the pattern that Jesus had was that he would come into his Father's presence and hear his Father speak love and truth to him. That's where he gained affirmation. And out of that affirmation, he found his worth. He could say, I am the resurrection. I am the way, the truth, and the life. He wasn't boasting, it was true. Because he knew in the presence of the Father who he was. And out of that, he had a significance. And out of that, flew his ministry. We, regrettably, do it the other way around so often. We want to find a role, we want to get our performance right, our work, our ministry, because we think that will give us a sense of significance. I'll feel a bit important and wanted, and that will give us affirmation. Well, that's okay for a while, but actually it takes us on a spiral that we go down and down and down until we're burnt out. The model of Jesus is to keep coming back to the Father. How do we do it? Well, I want to suggest two ways, and the first one is that we are ruthless about carving out time to be with our Father. And I say ruthless because all of us know that our intentions are good, but they're not put into practice. We heard about a man who went to a church in America where the pastor was Hybels. What's his name? Bill Hybels. Some of you will have heard of him. And this man was a very busy man. He was a consultant. And he said to Bill Hybels one day, "I love coming to your church. I love hearing a sermon each week you preach because I'm a very busy man. I simply don't have time to read the Bible and pray during the week. So, you know, I love coming to church." And Bill Hybels just said quietly, "Actually, I find I have time for what I value." And this really hit the man. And he went home and he thought, well, actually, this is important. I'm going to carve out 15 minutes a day. And he called it coffee with God. He sat down in his chair with a cup of coffee and he spoke to God. He let God speak back to him. He sometimes wrote. Sometime later, Bill Hybels met this man again and his wife. And he said to them, "How are you doing?" And before the man could answer, the wife replied, "My husband's a transformed man. And I want to say, this will change your life. I mean it." Because the more we come into the presence of God, the more we're restored, the more we're strengthened. Everything will conspire against it. But actually, why don't we make a commitment to carve out coffee with God? For some, it might be going for a walk with God. So that's the first thing. And the second thing I would say is that we need to be ruthless about dealing with the lies. You know, most of us, all of us, have been robbed by the lies we've chosen to believe. Our lives are diminished. We live in fear. We live in competition with one another. We struggle to believe our worth, all because we're choosing to believe lies. And I really do believe that God wants tonight for us to say we're going to wage war on them. One of the ways we can do this is by finding a friend or a home or a hub leader, whoever it is. And when we're aware of them, just say, "Look, I want in your presence to repent of this lie. I want to see it broken, and I want to choose to believe the truth." It doesn't happen instantly, but what I've found, because I've had to do this many times, and I know I'll have to go on doing it, what I find is over time, the inclination goes more towards the truth than to the lie. We still have to make that choice, but the inclination gets easier. Just recently, John and I went to speak at a conference, and there were some very high-powered people there. There was lords, ladies, viscount, political leaders. And I said to God, "I do not know what I'm doing here." I felt completely inadequate and useless. And I told God, "I don't think I've got anything here to give." What did God say to me? Well, he certainly didn't say, "You're right." He said to me, "Annie, that's fine, because actually my strength is made perfect in your weakness. It's okay to be weak. It's okay to feel inadequate, because my strength is made perfect in your weakness." I felt God say, "Go on, relax and enjoy it," which actually I did. Learn to be quick to bring the lies and rip got to be tough with them. We can't just play with them and say, well, that's who I am. Be tough on them. Learn to let God's voice ring in our hearts. I want just to close by giving the illustration of Moses, who I think has got something important to say to us. Moses had one of the most difficult jobs of all. He was leading this unruly rabble of people through the wilderness. They complained at every point, and it wasn't as though Moses even wanted the job. When God called him, he said, no, send somebody else. I certainly don't want it. He grew up in Pharaoh's palace. Most likely he was a rather arrogant young man, rather spoiled. We know that he killed an Egyptian and then went on the run so he didn't have to face up to it. Not really the makings of a leader, you might think. And yet we know that in his journey through the desert with the children of Israel, he kept going up to the mountain to speak with God. I just want to read you what it says about Moses when he died. It says, since then, no prophet has arisen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, who did all those miraculous signs and wonders. No one has ever shown the mighty power or performed the awesome deeds that Moses did in the sight of all Israel. I just want to say to myself and to all of us here, why don't we make that our aim? To be people who speak with God. To be people who, out of that encounter with God, are seeing the miraculous signs and wonders that King's Cross needs and our nation needs. God says, you can do it. Will you be willing to carve out time? Will you be willing to confront the lies? You will see God doing something far more wonderful than you ever dreamt or imagined, according to his power at work in you through Christ Jesus. Shall we stand?